So, did everybody get a chance to read the meeting notes, and is there a motion to approve on August 21st?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right. Opposed? We don't have any public guests?
It's a driver.
So we can probably move on to the executive committee that Roxanne's gonna, go through.
So in your package, you should have a couple of handouts. One is the update, the summary on the discussion that we had last time. There's some questions there, so we'll talk about that in a second. And then there's also criteria that we'll be having a discussion about today as well. So just to review, as we've talked about at previous meetings, we're working to update the 2018 planning calendar and then working on the 2019 work plan for that. We're having a lot of conversations about what some of the issues are that we want to really explore. And the topic of gun safety and violence prevention has really resonated with this group, and so we've had several discussions, as you all know, about that. And one of FACT's main roles is to advise the Board of Health on public health issues within the region. And so this is a topic that we really talked about: how do we do advocacy to the Board of Health around this issue? We've talked about also the need to be sensitive, not because this can be a hot topic, hot button topic. So not only being sensitive to the varying perspectives that we have on FACT, but also, the varying perspectives within our county and with the board. As we have these discussions.
And I think, Roxanne, that's where, we're focusing on the health.
Yep,
exactly. It's a bit like when we had the discussion on the Growing Healthier report a few years ago on climate change, same kind of issue, and that it was reframed to, the impact on human health, not climate change, but so that we have to think about making sure we frame it around the health of our
kids. Exactly. Yeah, and I think we've had a discussion. Gun control is charged language, so we need to really be thoughtful about how and what we're going to be advocating around with regard to this subject. So, totally on the button, what you just said. So we've been working with the public health staff, has been working with the FACT executive team and our managers to develop a process to identify where gun safety and violence prevention is already being addressed in some of the programs that we're doing. And last time we had a chance to look at that whole crosswalk. That's been part of the notes. So the crosswalk was a grid that you all had an opportunity to review. And at the last meeting, we reviewed not only what those items were that we're already working on, but some possible opportunities to advocate around those. And then along with what's currently being done, we also talked about, and this is one of your handouts, which is the background document. We also discussed these three questions. Are there other programs and projects in the community that we know about? Are there gaps that aren't currently being addressed? And do we need further information? So what we're gonna do is tonight, we're gonna briefly go over, I summarized all of the comments from last time, and we'll, some of you did not have the opportunity to be here, so we can have a little bit more dialogue around this if you wanted to, and add some additional things. Then the next thing we'll be doing is talking about the criteria for prioritizing opportunities that we've identified. So we'll look at the criteria document as well, and we'll have some chance to discuss that. And then if we have time, we'll also talk about additional community partners we might bring in, similar to what we've done with ESD 112 at their school safety program, and then the child death review that we talked about at our last meeting, to get a full understanding of what's going on in the community. And you all identified some opportunities there as well already. So that's what this is going to be, and I think we've got about, we'd like to probably do this within the next, I have a discussion in 20-30 minutes, so I'll probably keep it on track just to make sure that we can get to everything else that's on the agenda. So, sound okay? Any questions? All right, you guys. It's great to talk to you when your mouth is clear, right? Questions always mumble. All right. So, if you can take a look at the summary document with the three questions on it. Basically, what we did is we had a full discussion around this. You guys broke into groups and came up with some ideas. The first question we talked about are there programs or projects in the community that we already know about? And you all identified there's hunter and gun safety, owner safety courses that are already going on. Project Child Safe, which we're actually going to talk a little bit more about later tonight. There's the Safe Kids Coalition that's doing some work around this, around gun safety and violence prevention. Suicide Outreach and Hotlines we came up with. The Strengthening Families Program at WSU. There's the TNTT program at Legacy. I'm not familiar with TNTT set in the West. Did anybody know what that is? It was part of our notes.
I think that's the Trauma Nurses Talk Tap.
There you go, Trauma Nurses Talk Tap. Okay, good. Thank you. And then, obviously, the ACES training that we've been doing. So, are there other programs and projects in the community that aren't identified here, especially for those of you that had a chance to kind of commentate on this, but those of you that were here last year, is there anything else that we know about that's going on in the community that's addressing this?
American Academy of Pediatrics, the primary care providers in this county, giving advice to families, so through their examinations.
And I think you have nurse-family partnership, okay. You know, just safety in the home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anything else that we're aware of in the community? Well, this is not the end of this conversation. So as things come up and you're aware of things, as you become aware of things, we can certainly add those to the list and add those as potential things that you might want to talk about moving forward. The second question we talked about, are there other gaps that aren't being addressed or fully addressed? And the things we came up with was there's not really a lot of targeted and general education around this. There's like pockets of this and that, but there's not a lot of targeted or general education that's really consistent. So that's one gap that we talked about. There's not a lot of statistics around this. You know, where are we going to pull the data from? Because that's another thing that we want to make sure is whatever topics we talk about, specifically, we want to make sure that there's data. So statistics can be kind of challenging. Ammo disposal programs is something that somebody came up with and said it's a huge problem in our community. And there's also a disjointed approach to this in the community. So based on what we talked about at the last meeting, that's what we came up with. Do you guys think that there's any other gaps that you thought about that might
need to be addressed? You know, in terms of statistics, what kind of information does law enforcement have about issues related to especially children having access to guns? You know, an accidental, you know, just any kind of incident reports related to gun handling, especially by minors.
Uh-huh. Bob, do you have any information on that? Do you have any statistics on that?
I don't know about statistics where children were injured with guns. We can look through our records database to see if we have any accidental shooting reports. And then we have to drill down and see what the circumstances were. I don't know if ER rooms keep track of that kind of information. Mm-hmm. And obviously, if it was a fatality, then you'd go to the coroner's office, medical examiner's office. So,
but aren't all gunshot wounds or whatever reported to the police? Don't they all have to be reported to you guys?
Well, generally, yeah, because somebody generally calls us. So yes, it would just be a matter of how you get. If you're talking about accidental shootings involving children, you're going to have to drill down and read reports. They're not going to be that many.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I can think of, in our city, I think we've had one accidental shooting that was a fatality involving a child, and that was about 9 years ago. So.
Wow.
But I think, you know, as we talk about, one of the things that we've talked about is gun locks. And
sure.
There's a lot of education about gun locks, and are gun locks working, I guess, is the... It would be that the question that we want to see if there's any data, you know, is that an effective prevention
sure.
method? Makes sense, but,
right.
You know.
So, anything else? Any other thoughts around gaps?
We might be able to mine stuff on the VRFS and healthy youth yeah. survey. There are questions there that
uh-huh.
check a look at.
Yeah.
Well, is there anything in the one that's done every couple of years by the CDC through the state with that, the behavioral?
I think BRFA is the Behavioral Risk Factor Survey.
Is there anything?
It's done every year. I think there are. I have to take a look at it and see if there are far most questions on
it. Yeah, there are. We can add that to the purpose.
And one of the things that we have done is the Healthy Youth Survey. There's actually, if you want additional questions put on it, there's a payment that you have to do associated with those. We've actually paid to have a far most question put on the Healthy Youth Survey for the next round. So we'll have opportunities to get some additional data around this issue.
Did you say you wanted to request it?
Yeah, I think it's the next round, which will be, it's 2018 now. Maybe they've already, being done this fall.
Yeah.
So we probably should have some data from it 2019.
Next year.
Mm-hmm. That's a yearly survey.
Every two years.
Yeah.
And we actually agreed to pay for some firearms questions on it. It's going to be done, a number of counties could agree to do that. We put some additional dollars in.
Do you remember what questions, what kind of questions?
We can find out for you. What's also great about the Healthy Youth Survey is you can do cross tabs. So there's tabs in there about suicidal ideation, for example, and then there'll be some questions about firearms, and you can look at these issues at the same time.
So. And that data goes back to Department of Public Health, or that Healthy Youth Survey goes to the...
Well, you can actually look at the data online. Mm-hmm. It's all anonymous. There's thousands of kids. It's 6th, 8th, 10th, and 12th graders in the county, and we have a pretty good, I think response rate is over 70%. It's anonymous. And you can look at the county data. So it's available.
And it's distributed through the public health department.
We have access to it.
But that's who runs the survey?
State Department.
The State Department of Health.
And it's going through schools, and we also have some agreements with some of the school districts to drill down on some additional data for them, which is not public, which we don't share publicly. So aggregated data, but they want to know some information specifically, and so we've been able to do that.
I think you can go down at the district level, mm-hmm. and then
yeah, the school
and
level.
Then if you want, but the public can't go down to school level, can
no.
they? Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah, but it gives them opportunities to take a look at their own policies and procedures, which is fantastic. So.
Does that also go to private schools?
I'm sorry?
Does it also go to private schools?
I don't think it does. I think it's only private schools.
And parents opt out.
Uh-huh.
So why we have the 70% of families have the choice, they have the choice to opt out.
Do we keep track of how many times a child is, or how many times a weapon is brought to a school?
I have to take a look at the specific questions.
Mm-hmm.
You mean on the Healthy Youth Survey or just in general?
In general. I mean, do we keep track of that?
I would think that, yes. I think that there's either going to be a police report, but all the school districts have their own internal reporting systems where they capture data. And if they had a student with a gun on campus, there's going to be some kind of record of that. So.
But nobody does any kind of report, like in 2017 there were X number of weapons?
Probably not, other than the health. You know, even that is not, the school administrators aren't answering that, so I can't answer that question.
Do they confiscate them?
Depends what the circumstances are. I mean, mm-hmm. I can tell you, you know, it depends, and I hate to say that, but we had a kid, had a hunting rifle, takes it out of a car, is going to drive home, but decides he wants to drive by the school and get his gym gear. Well, he comes onto campus with a firearm. Hmm. Mandatory arrest, mandatory psych evaluation, mandatory booking into the juvenile hall because the laws are very strict, but you could tell there was never any intent for him to do any of that, but that's just what the law tells him mm-hmm. to do. So they're very strict on guns on campuses.
So those numbers are small, but I think from the Healthy Youth Survey, we'll get some more data on this.
Because I think there's one, have you ever carried a gun on campus, a weapon on campus? Have you ever seen one?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The child death review that we're doing as well will give us some additional data as well. So that'll be another data source that we'll be able to use for next year. And And we're really working, I mean, that can be a little bit of a gap, right? Because we just don't have, you know, we don't have a lot of information, so. Anything else that you're thinking of, gaps-wise, that hasn't necessarily been adequately addressed?
You talked about another VA that wasn't on here. I don't know if that's a gap or a community project. I don't know.
So I do have VA listed under doing better information, but they might be a good source of, if there's a possibility that they may be a source of data that we could potentially take a look at as well.
Bullying is asked about on the healthy youth survey too, so you get more information on that.
That was something that came up repeatedly in the conversation. Okay, well, if you're thinking of it, so these, like I said, these are open-ended questions, and as you're thinking about this topic, if there's anything else that you feel like, hey, there's this that I've discovered, or there's this that I was thinking about, we can certainly add things to this list. This is not going to be an ongoing kind of conversation as we develop this work plan around this. The third question we said is, do we need any further information? So partner, stakeholder presentations, information, research, is there anything else that we feel like we really need, or that there's gaps in that regard? Again, statistics came up. Current laws, there's not really an understanding about what the current laws are, and Bob, you just mentioned that there's some very strict laws around it, but we're not necessarily as a group real up to date on what those are. So that might be an area where we could, you know, pull in some additional information from the group. School and organizational policies. Bullying, like I mentioned, came up a lot. And so what are the policies around bullying? How are those changing? Are those being effective? Is there data around that? You know, those are a lot of questions around that we might be able to take on together. Not just in the schools, but in our other organizations too. So that came up last time. And then finally, the stakeholder perspective. Can we bring in some gun owners or dealers or get their perspective? Safe Kids, the Safe Kids Coalition, nonprofits, law enforcement, behavior and physical health providers, the Veterans Association, Fish and Game, WSU, and others, you know, university level. Are there any other stakeholders that you feel like we could potentially look at, or any other information?
You know, one of the things when Paul first talked with me about, you know, his interest in bringing us here about gun safety, you know, we focused on the gun, but if you look at it, it was about the time that Sandy Hook parents were running some public service announcements. And in those public service announcements, you know, it's like a lot of the kids that have gotten guns, it's not been an issue of the gun, it's been a better behavior of the child that was, and it, so when Sandy Hook parents read their public service announcements, they're fabulous. I think they're still on the internet. It showed, you know, because they wanted to work that same kind of goal that they had about education and educating the public. And so these public service announcements were, you know, there's a classroom and there's a kid who's wearing all these black clothes and this kind of stuff, and they're worried about him because he's very apparent and, you know, he's going to be. And then it shows scene two with, it shows a kid shooting somebody, and then, or a violence thing, and then you look at who did it. And you look at the kid that, you know, dressed up, you know, in the black clothes, and, you know, some of what's been portrayed about kids. And then there's the kid in the classroom that's just sitting there quietly withdrawn, et cetera. And in fact, that's the kid you're worried about. And they make this point in this very excellent educational public service announcement about it's really paying attention to the behaviors of the kids. And we're focusing so much on guns instead of, you know, like we heard from the threat assessment team a couple of times ago, how can we identify those kids who are being bullied by other kids or who are loners and, you know, withdrawn, because they're more likely to be somebody who acts violently toward others than somebody that goes around dressing in some of the goth type of stuff, which doesn't mean they're going to be shooting them. Mm-hmm.
So, I remember talking to a partner that just please. Say that, we had a relative of a neighbor who was a juvenile correctional officer. He said 100% of the time, so they took a kid into custody for taking a gun to school, they were being bullied. 100% of the time.
we'll be able to look at those crosstabs. I believe both questions will be, if I remember correctly, on the healthy youth survey, so we'll be able to look at that as well.
But that's another along the law enforcement, juvenile justice might be an area that we can tap into, which I think is so hugely important. And to what you're saying, I mean, maybe the advocacy opportunities are around continuing that sort of trauma-informed organizations. I mean, you've already started down that road with ACEs. I mean, the group has done such tremendous work around it already. And that might be an area that folks to the top that we could want to continue to advocate for. Thank you. And what does that really mean? What does trauma-informed really mean?
Well, we get back to the data that the threat assessment piece of that presentation, that powerful community asset, looking at what they're doing in the schools, and it's invisible. We were all amazed at the work that our ESD was doing in the threat assessment. So I think that they need to be a stakeholder group and help with it.
So do you know if that survey asks about bullying at all?
Yes, it does. Yeah, there's other questions too. Yeah. So like Alan was saying, we can do all these crosstabs, which is pretty cool. And now with our new firearms question on it, we can crosstab it with suicide ideation, suicide attempts, being depressed, bullying, have all kinds of very rich
drug use, alcohol use.
That can really help us to understand what the problem really is, which I think will be fantastic. So we'll definitely use that as a source of data for us. But there also, I mean, there's some challenges with it too, because it doesn't hit all. You know, this is a survey that's done in the schools, so it doesn't hit all students. And especially if we've got a student that's moving from school to school to school to school, it might not pick up everybody. That might be a high risk. So. You know, it's not perfect, but it certainly is a great data source to use to tell a larger story.
Well, yeah, and that's something that we learned from the ESD conversations, that a lot of these kids are younger than the sixth grade and start having being bullied. And a lot of these kids have a lot of her problems for students that were really way younger than I would have been.
I had no idea that there was such an increase in the number of children under the age of 10 who have either attempted or completed suicide because of bullying and the social media stuff. That just blows me away. when Sam was in middle school, he was bullied quite a bit, and it was very difficult for me because they were bullying him about the fact that his mother had a mental illness. And I went to the counselors, I went to the principals, I went to the teachers, and you know, it was almost like they just lost it over. Uh-huh. There really wasn't that much concern about it. Uh-huh. And I find that very disturbing. And I think that we really need to find some way to focus on that type of education being delivered to the schools, to the parents, yeah, you know, to the kids. And you know, there's got to be some kind of disciplinary actions taken, because when we've got kids under 10 years of age killing themselves because they're being bullied, their lives haven't even started. That terrifies me.
It's so tragic.
Actually, another stakeholder, I guess, uh-huh, would be that Safe Schools Coalition.
Safe Schools. Uh-huh. Any other thoughts around this? And did we miss anything? I mean, are these even the right questions? Are there other questions that we need to ask from your perspective?
We keep looking at children in schools and, you know, the elderly.
Yeah.
There are many men who have their service revolver or have, you know, a weapon that was passed down from their father or you know, and I think gunshot is the number one choice or whatever for suicide attempt or completion or whatever. But I think we need to think about how we reach the elderly population, not just the schools, but the older folks, because that's what they turn to.
I do think that the data is bearing out that the elderly population, that's and Ellen, you probably have more data in your head around this, but it is a one of the leading causes of non-disease related death in our elderly population. And certainly the VA, you know, the VA has done a lot of work around this too, a lot of our veterans. So I don't disagree with you that should be, you know, we're focusing a little bit on youth, and that's great, but there might be some opportunities for advocacy around this as well, because there is, the data will bear that out as well.
Elderly men have high suicide rates. That's been true for a long time.
I was really, this month is Suicide Awareness Month, and I've been watching like the Golden Gate Bridge things and different YouTube presentations on suicide and people that have done. You'd be surprised how many women use handguns. I was like, what a beautiful woman, and she used a handgun? I mean, there's no open casket there.
Well, you're a lot more effective in finishing it off if you're using it. So last I looked around, 2/3 of suicides were done with handguns, but that's because you're a lot more successful. I mean, one of the other reasons, you're a lot more successful in completing it if you have a handgun. So it's an effective form.
It might be interesting to do some kind of data analysis of looking at what are the different data sources, and then what some of the concerns or issues are with the different data sources. So I'm thinking, I don't know if this is still true, but at one point in Multnomah County, I know they talked about police data sometimes is, well, it's a city report, but is not always consistent in how they report gun violence, whether it's suicide or whatever. Sometimes it gets classified under other issues.
Yeah.
I know, like, health use survey, self-selection is, you know, a little bit, self-reporting is a little bit, but also I think the schools are tend to be very protective of their data, because, you know, last thing the school wants to see is cover the Columbian or whatever paper that they have issues in their school. So it might be interesting just to be able to look at what data is available and what the pros and cons or the concerns about the different data sources are. I don't know if that would be too big a lift for the assessment.
It would be interesting to have a case study and see how the police reported it, how the school reported it, how, you know, information from mom or dad, and just look. That would be very interesting, I think, to me, to find out, you know, how we look at it, because everyone's got a perspective of it, and then the company, the agency, whatever, their perspective of it. And you're right, I think the school's would be very, very protective of, you know, especially if there's a bullying incident. I think there's major lawsuit there.
Well, the schools don't report that, but bullying is a question that's asked on the Healthy Youth Survey. Sometimes for some of the, so the schools have data down to the districts have data down to the school level, but it tends, like Janice is saying, that schools don't necessarily like to share all the data, because you can paint a picture of a particular school. And that's not, so we need to be careful with the data and how it's interpreted. But with what Janice is saying is, when we present this to you, we'll have all that, those caveats with it. We'll explain where the data comes from, what its quality is, you know, how we can look at it, what level we can look at it. We'll have the assessment unit does a really good job on that.
So is Josh the person that's with Safe Kids, or is he with a different group?
I'm sorry?
Josh Beeman, is he with Safe Kids, or is he with he works with the gang-related kids?
He might be with Safe Kids.
Safe Kids Coalition.
That was the Safe Kids Coalition. Okay, I just wanted to make sure we were getting the perspective from the people, you know, from law enforcement and Safe Kids that work with the kids that are affected by gangs. Because that's, again, a stakeholder group that...
Yeah.
Just wonder if
the gang task force members and
about data. I think one of the difficulties is that, and it was mentioned, is that different agencies and even different individuals understand the parameters different ways.
Yes.
And then there's maybe vast differences between agencies and individuals about how they collect, analyze, and report the data. One of our daughters worked in LA County Health Department on a CDC project to study violent deaths. And she had a hard time getting data from agencies that might be able to help put the puzzle pieces together, because they didn't want to share for many understandable reasons. But then even when the data came in, it was hard to know what to do with it, because the definitions about some of the same common things were very different.
Yep.
So if there's something, if we were going to do anything about being able to get data that we could use, it might be, is there some way we could promote some standard practices around data collection definitions and things?
So in terms of violent deaths and all that, one of the reasons for doing the child death review, the numbers will be small in Clark County, thankfully, but it's all going into a national, I think David talked about it at last FAC meeting, it's going into a national database, so the numbers are greater, and we'll be able to, certainly it's hard to break it down by small geography, but once you have that larger data set, you can, and actually the idea is to do exactly what you're talking about, standardize the data elements, so everybody's doing it the same way in every community. And I hope, I don't know when we'll have some data on the child death review, we're just getting started with that, but we'll be able to mine that data and take a look at it. So that would be something else we can present to you.
And is it the Healthy Youth Survey, are all states required to do something like that, or is it voluntary?
So states have something similar. Healthy Youth Survey is Washington State, but it's basically,
Youth Risk Behavior Survey that the CDC puts out.
Correct.
Can I ask about the Healthy Youth Survey, though? It's got, even within Clark County, the numbers are huge. You're talking about tens of thousands, or thousands of students.
But it's just like what you're saying, it's like standardizing that so that you can get a national impression of the youth health. Right?
So the questions on the Healthy Youth Survey are pretty well standardized.
So that you can kind of pool. And that information through each state is available to you.
Yeah, but
see trends or however it may be. Yeah.
Well, I think, I think that the issues with Healthy Youth Survey aren't really there. That's a really good survey. It's not
right.
Really discussed. Yeah. But I think, Marla and I were on the Healthy Columbia Willamette Collaborative together, and we wanted to look at Medicaid data and hospital data, and everybody's like, yay, let's go do that. And then you start looking at the data, and it's just, it's when you're looking at data that's collected by different organizations, hospitals, law enforcement, whatever it is, from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, agency to agency, there might be different definitions of words or how they collect the data. I mean, it's almost impossible to bring it together and come up with any kind of consistency.
Actually, if you want to go look at injury data, you might go talk to Glenn Whitworth with the MPD's office, because he's going to have all the first responder outcome data as far as what was found on the scene for the ambulance in each one of the fire departments. So,
who is that?
Glenn Whitworth.
Oh, okay.
He's the medical director. We might want to have him come and talk about it. He's the only one.
So, were there any other questions that you think we should consider as we're putting this work plan together? And the other question I have for you is, are you guys still good with the process? Any concerns about the process we're going through to try to...
Can I just ask a question?
Sure.
So I think what I hear we're going to try to do is get a list of all the potential, or what we can identify as potential data sets that address this issue, and not present the data yet, but just get like a table of contents, or I don't know what it is, an idea of what data are out there, and then we can take a look and at some point talk about what the limitations or what the benefits are, and get that. Is that?
I think where we're at right now, what we're doing internally right now, is looking at data sets that we have available to us.
Yeah.
And also the quality of that data.
Yeah.
So that's what we've already kind of started down
okay.
that road. But there's a lot of other data sets that may be out there that we haven't considered. So that's why this is such a good conversation, is because there may be some other sources that, we have our normal sources, which are, our ER data and our Healthy Youth Survey, all that stuff. But there may be some additional data sources that we haven't explored yet, and so there may be opportunities there to build some relationships around that data and see if we can get some additional information. So, this is about. But the other, yes.
Oh, I just wanted to say, and I think it's a good process. I think that it's very thoughtful, and we're getting some of the right questions answered. But I also, in the group that I was with last month, when we were talking about some of the questions that we were addressing, was the issue of where in the process do we assess our potential role in the bigger picture of this? Because I was really surprised to find out there were so many other groups and organizations that are working on this and care about it. And so who decides? Who are the conveners? Who are the organizers? Is there a hierarchy? Is there, and so that we can try to think about where is our role best served in the bigger scheme of all these other organizations. And I don't even know how to think about that, because I'm just hearing last month for the first time that there were all these other ones too.
One unique role that you all have is that you advise the board at Pedal. So need to think about that.
Mm-hmm. So that makes me think that we might be in a convener role with respect to some of these agencies, so that we can gather information from them and bring it forward to the Board of Health, because they're not in a position to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. So that is one of the thoughts that I had.
I think another thing that I think we have to be really strategic about is making sure we have a clear delineation of what the issue is that, mm-hmm. that we're bringing forward and what we're advocating for. And I think right now, we talk about gun safety, we talk about violence prevention, we really have to make sure, even if it's a three-part or four-part, we really need to be very crystal clear, because when you start taking action on a problem that you've identified, you want to make sure you're going down the right path.
So it's not necessarily gun control as much as it is gun safety.
But I think language is really important in terms of crafting. Once we look at the data and we come up with this clearly, what is the problem we're wanting to put forth that we want to advocate for some action on, or some solutions on, or some recommendations on? And it could be a three-part definition, but we need to be crystal clear on that.
One big learning I had too last month was came from Bob, and it was about not alienating some of the organizations that we might not necessarily, I might not personally align with, but they have, they may have some opportunity to really be key sources of information and support for things that we care about too. So words are really important, and language is going to be key to any kind of effectiveness.
And the stakeholder piece is key in identifying who all the stakeholders are and what they can add. Yep.
So next step was actually going to be talking a little bit more about that, about we've got a laundry list of things and ideas we've come up with, and that list will grow and change over time as we discover more things that are happening in our community. And we'll be bringing those stakeholders on to have conversations with us, so that will help us not only understand, but also recognize that there may be some opportunities to advocate for some other things that we haven't yet identified. So we need to keep sort of an open mind around that. But we also need to take our laundry list of ideas and start putting together a work plan and vet those ideas and really narrow it down to what Jim is saying. Really narrow it down so that we're crystal clear on what it is that we're doing. And there may be some things that we come up with that we're very interested in as a group, but it doesn't make sense for that as a group to advocate for to the Board of Health. It may be an issue that you all can go back and work with community partners on, help them, work within your own organizations, send letters to, if there's something going on at the state, we want to send a letter about that. That's things like that. So I think as time goes on, we'll also identify other opportunities that may not fit with what FAC needs to do, but might fit with, what you as individuals and citizens can do as well. So I think that's a valuable process.
Roxanne, as you're talking, I think another group that we might want to talk to is there a local chapter of the NRA, and what are they doing about education, about gun safety? Mm-hmm. We know there's politics around it, but we're not, again, talking about gun control. We're talking about how do they promote education about the safe use of firearms? And I think that then that, just as Bob says, that, you know, that we could probably learn some things from what they're doing that we have missed through the politics.
That's how we got started as an organization, wasn't it?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't belong to it, so. I know it's shocking, but.
The NRA.
That's what the original mission was, wasn't it? I think.
He's a lifetime member.
But I think that's a stakeholder group.
Yeah.
If we think about, you know, we'll try to be as apolitical as possible, because if we focus, we're not focusing on, we're going to fight the NRA, we're going to support the NRA. The issue is, what are they doing to help educate the public and families, et cetera, about the use of safety of firearms?
I think another important stakeholder would be like community mental health agencies, for example. I mean, they're doing risk assessments all the time for their clients, and they're talking about gun safety and appropriately locking up guns. So I think we may not get data from them, but I think they would be an important stakeholder in the conversation.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Continue to have our group together, and having a DSD representative here and having a youth representative here might help, because those are the two big goals that we have that might have to, you know,
yes.
input, because those are the two, I mean, that's a huge group cover.
It's not just the gun safety part, it's really the violence prevention part. I mean, when we look at our disturbance with the weapons, there's a lot more weapons out there. We get probably more stabbings than we get shootings. And it's really how do you deal with the violence prevention and the trauma prevention side of stuff. And guns are very effective, but they're also
right. That's where when we talked about the language we wanted to say, are we really, how do we want to craft that? What's our priority? Is it violence prevention or gun safety? I mean, that's just very crude right now, but that's where we want to be very focused on. Once we get this data, what do we want to focus on?
Or just breaking the cycle of people believing that they need guns to be safe. I mean, most people are taught that you keep the pistol or whatever in a safe, and then you've got the bullets out of the pistol, and so you get to get the bullets from a drawer and get to the safe. If somebody's breaking into your house, how are you going to get all that done? And what you're talking about street violence or violence among gangs or that kind of stuff, if we can get people to think differently about it, the children to think differently about violence, that it's not acceptable to be in a shootout, whereas now it's glamorized almost with some of the hip-hop singers and whatever died by this method because they were famous, and there's the East and West Coast and whatever shootouts. But I think just changing the culture and the thought around having the gun, I have to have my gun on me to be safe when I go to school or when I go out into the community or whatever. I mean, I think if you're looking at it from the way the NRA looks at it, mostly for hunting or home safety or whatever, versus I've got to have it with me at all times, you know, in multiple, you know, weapons of mass destruction or whatever, trying to just change the way that children look at it so that in 10, 20 years, our culture won't be the kind that walks around with pistols and whatever at the grocery store. Does that make sense?
It does, but I think that's just a small part of it. I mean, there's probably more concealed weapons out there than you can even begin to imagine.
Oh, yeah, but you have to have a permit, right?
They are permitted, but there's a ton of them. But it's really the part that's most devastating is that retaliation part, right? That's where kids get involved. That's where violence happens in the bars, on the street, wherever. It's that thought of retaliation or that cycle of retaliation and the cycle of violence, essentially. And that's the part you have to figure out. How do we break that? How do we break what's causing that retaliation, whether that's bullying in the schools or ostracization? You know, that's the part I think that we have to be able to identify and say, how do we
how do we stop this at a more younger level?
So you're talking about conflict resolution as well.
Yeah.
How do people resolve? And actually working with even with kids on how to resolve things like how do you resolve conflicts.
Yeah, there's some classrooms that are starting a restorative justice program.
Yeah.
You know, teaching those conversations to kids, and you talk about it, you talk about it, you talk about it, you talk about it until you're done.
And I think that would be helpful. I mean, it, all levels, all ages, learning how to be able to be successful in mitigating or coming to terms with or whatever. Yeah. Coming from an advocate, I believe
well,
you should be able to.
That gets back to the conversation that we had last time about, you know, getting a better understanding of what the targeted in general education is in our community. I think there is a lot of there's probably a lot of work going on. I mean, we've heard bits and snippets from our partners, but it's very disjointed. So figuring out, you know, kind of what is happening, what's the data behind it, what's the effectiveness of that, and then that might be something that FAC could potentially advocate for. If it's a policy sort of policy-driven, you know, change that we could potentially advocate for
to improve the health of the community.
There you go.
Some of this is all of us becoming better trauma-informed also.
Right.
And I'd be curious to hear more from Bob Rings about the experiences officers had when they went through, you know, training and being trauma-informed, because part of, you know, conflict resolution is to be able to understand what somebody else's experience is and where they're coming from. So I'd be curious to hear more about that. I don't know if it has helped them resolve conflicts.
Well, you know, we've trained all our officers in trauma-informed care. We've trained all our officers in crisis intervention training to de-escalate situations. We don't go hands-on like we used to on people. I mean, we don't even carry nightsticks anymore. I mean, it's those kinds of things.
It'd be great to hear more about that and whether other police agencies have adopted what you're doing.
Yeah, I think everybody has. I mean, it's a sign of the times. You know, I think there's an over-reliance in some cases. Well, you could, two things. My generation, you were taught, taught really quickly. You asked, you told, you made them do it. That's what, three steps, every call. You asked somebody to comply, you told them to comply, they didn't comply, you made them comply. And it's completely different now, to the point where now you have generational issues where you have a field training officer that's kind of old school, and you have a trainee that's been through all this crisis intervention training, and slow the process down if you can, and try to de-escalate. So then what happens, you've got the FTO saying, well, my trainee, he's...
Fails to engage.
Fails to engage, he's not engaging quick enough. And so then you have this balance act, because if you engage too fast, you escalate things. If you engage too slow, you escalate things.
Yeah.
So you got to find that point where it works. And so those are we have those conversations and those conflicts every day. You know, me personally, I think there's an over-reliance on tasers in a lot of ways, because that's not the, especially it doesn't work in the Pacific Northwest. People think, oh, tasers, everybody's got coats. You know, everybody's got layers of clothing. Southern California, man, they don't, you know, December, you're in a t-shirt, taser works really good up here. It's got to make contact with skin. So, so those are the kinds of things people don't realize, but it's the truth. But I think, you know, kids that we have nowadays are much more prepared to try to de-escalate things. But on the flip side, I think we have a lot of kids nowadays that don't have good communication skills, because they text their entire, they're on social media all day. They don't talk to people anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I've told you guys this before. It's like, you know, if you could text a driver and tell them to pull over and then come back and get my ticket, they can do a great job. But then if they have to get up and actually talk to a stranger, it's just like, oh, I don't want to do that. You go, well, that's what this job's about.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know, you know, you stop people all day long. You don't know who they are, right? And so it's. But with that being said, they're much more prepared to deal with a lot more things than when I started. So.
Has there been a focus on collecting data around these change policies within law enforcement as a whole, like trauma-informed?
Most of the data we collect nowadays, honestly, is very detailed reports on use of force. And it's not just, and we've actually changed our process now. So if you use, And for our agency, use of force is you grab somebody and put your hands on them to up to you shoot them with a handgun, right? So there's all these levels. And it's used to be just check boxes. And now we've got to more narrative where we prompt the officer to we ask them questions. Why did you use force? What alternatives did you consider before you used this force? And you can say, well, I was going to use my taser, but I noticed the person was standing in water and, you know, they're 20 feet off the ground, and if I shot them with a taser, they're going to fall, hit their head, and they're going to get hurt. So that's why I went hands-on with the guy instead. So they're walking through these scenarios. So we collect all kinds of data on that now. It's pretty detailed. And we collect, age and race of everybody, and we look at the demographics and everybody. That's kind of a trend nationwide now. So that's how we collect our use of force data. And most agencies in the United States are collecting some type of use of force information now. So
have you been able to equate the changes in or mitigating reasons behind use of force with some of these trainings that you rolled out? Have you been able to do any of that?
I don't think it's that black and white, but right. What I will tell you though is there are a lot less, even with the taser, and one of the things people forget about the taser is we used to hurt and kill a lot more people before we had tasers. Now, yeah, tasers can cause injury. People can die. And there's still debate over whether it's the taser or the side effects of the taser, because a lot of the people we deal with have a lot of other medical issues. Yeah. But with that being said, we used to hit people with clubs. And that was perfectly okay. I mean, you walk up and there's a fight and you would send them to the club and you'd break their arm or their leg and you send them to the hospital. And everybody was okay with that, right? I mean, in those days. But now you get a taser out and you can shoot them with a taser because, oh my God, it's terrible. But there's a lot less injuries of suspects and a lot less injuries of officers. And people, one of the good things about a taser is not so much taking the taser and shooting somebody with it, but it's actually when you take the little taser cap, the wires off and just spark it, people have a natural fear of electricity. And a lot of people comply just by you threatening to use that. And that's what we want. We want you to, I was taught a long time ago, it's easier to talk somebody in the handcuffs and you talk them into the back of the car and you're nice and you talk them all the way to the jail and you say, hey, have a nice day, see you later, and get out of there. That's how I was taught. And so I think, with that being said, I think there's a lot less injuries all the way around, both suspects and officers.
Do you think
that
trauma informed care has made the officers more compassionate?
Yes, I think that, along with, we did a lot of ACEs training, we did a lot of teen brain, adolescent brain development. So our officers now, and not only that, we rewrote a lot of our policies. So when we come in contact with juveniles now, we used to run a lot of, we only run about 20% of all the kids we have contact with, only 20% of them end up coming down to the juvenile detention facility. The other 80% are released to parents, released back to the school, or we just take a report and go by way of complaint. So I think that says a lot for how all the agencies in Clark County are training, but we've actually discouraged our officers from taking kids down to juvenile detention because it just makes them worse. You add more ACEs onto their life. And so and then the other thing we did with our school resource program is working with the schools and the prevention intervention specialists, we take a lot of police reports on a lot of kids, and instead of arresting them, we refer them right into the schools, the services the schools provide. So alcohol and drug abuse treatment, smoking, anger management, any of those things that you're talking about, we don't even put them in the juvenile justice system anymore. If they're a battleground high school kid, or they're in a battleground school that has a prevention intervention specialist, we refer them right into the system. And because that's where their family is, that's where their social circle is, they're in school and they're in the classroom instead of taking them out of that environment. So it's so we're trying to make things better for them and not make it worse. So,
you're my hero.
That's just,
why are you not chief of police or something? You are my hero.
So that's what we're doing. I mean, it takes, we've got guys that have been cops for a long time, and it takes a long time to turn that mindset around, but the younger kids get it because that's all they know. They come out of the academy with a lot of this information now, and they get it, where the guys have been around a long time, like me, I didn't know what ACEs was in 1980, and I didn't know what adolescent brain development was. All I knew is I told a kid, hey, don't do A, and they did A. And you go, oh, you're defiant. I'm going to arrest you for being defiant. I'm going to take you down to juvenile hall because you're not listening to me. Well, it's a lot more, it's biology. It's not, yeah, so I don't want to get off my soapbox, but that's the way it is.
So you can teach old dogs nature, right?
Especially old dogs.
Well, we'll continue to have some more dialogue around this. I'm going to wrap this up for right now because we're running a little low on time. If you all have additional comments that you want to make or thoughts, you're welcome to share. Just email me.
I know we're running short of time, but can you talk a little bit about the criteria real quick?
No. That's what I was launching into right now. So the next thing I'd like to talk about is your other handout is the criteria. So what the process will be is we've identified, as I mentioned, a bunch of stuff that we're going to be looking at. But we also need to have some criteria around how we're going to vet the ideas that we've come up with around what it is that fat can do. And to Marla's point, we really do need to decipher what the roles and responsibilities of fat are and make sure that we are very clear on that so that we can, you know, we're not getting into the weeds in an area where other people are doing work or we're thinking that we can do this direct work because really that's not our role. So, public health staff work with the executive team, and we came up with these questions. These may or may not be good questions. The thought was we would just have a dialogue around if these questions are good and what else we might need to add. So these are the questions. Number one, is it in line with FAT's role as an advisory to the Board of Health? So that would be one potential question we could ask. Are we able to provide data, good data? What is the time commitment around whatever it is that we're going to be considering to advocate around? Do we have the staff subject matter expertise and capacity? Because there may be some things that we'll need to bring in public health staff to try to, you know, do some research around. So do we have capacity to do that? Are members willing to serve on a work group or a task force potentially, depending on what the issue is? Is it politically feasible? Is it an urgent or pressing issue locally, regionally, statewide, or nationally? Is it an emerging issue that we need to maybe jump on right away? Does it impact a vulnerable population? So we really want to consider equity and disparities when we're thinking about what it is we're going to be advocating for. Do we have broad community support? Because that's going to be critical as well. And are there others locally, regionally, statewide, or nationally working on this issue? And if there are, is our role to help to advocate for that work, or what would our role be in that regard? So we can talk about these questions, but also are there other questions that we might want to add, or is there anything on here that's given anybody any comfort?
I think we need a question about how does it impact the health of the community? Because we're here to improve the health of the citizens of Clark County. And so, you know, does this relate to improving health? It needs to be an early on question.
Okay. Well, I think that would be, as an alignment of PAC's role, and her role is to improve the health, promote public partner participation, providing for communication, so improving health, improving public participation, providing communication. That's the number one thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, spell out those three bullets. Because it could be important, but does it have something to do with the health of the community?
Right.
You know, that's where, you know, that's where our purview.
And if the question is no, it doesn't, it may still be an issue that resonates, and that might be one of those things where you say, okay, well, then what can I do with this in my own agency or something mm-hmm. like that. Any other thoughts around the list? Do you guys like the list? Is there anything on here that you feel like we should?
The cost of, like, the monetary commitment on there somewhere?
The fiscal impact.
Fiscal impact. Fiscal impact. Thank you.
Do you have a timeline?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the time commitment and mm-hmm. what's the timeline?
Mm-hmm. Time commitment, timeline. Okay.
Probably want to know, is it something we can measure, that we've actually made an impact or not? So
if we can make an impact?
A measure.
Is there a measure?
No, you have a measure.
Yep.
Watson, I'm sorry, I have to go. Sam has a date.
Oh, excellent, okay.
And
such a good one.
I promised them that we'd leave about 7, so.
If you have any other thoughts, just email me.
Okay.
I have a question. Who would be our subject matter expert regarding whether something is feasible?
Well, I think that's a conversation that we probably need to have within VAC. So one of the things that was brought up early on was gun control is probably not going to be particularly feasible. And I think that's a conversation we need to have with the VAC group. Is this something that we feel like we can get on at all?
But that's one of the advantages of VAC, though. You guys are all subject matter experts, and you all come from different perspectives. So based on all your perspectives, I think VAC can itself determine what's politically feasible. I mean, every community is different. What's feasible in one community, what's feasible in Lubbock, Texas, is probably not feasible in Vancouver, Washington. But you guys can figure that out.
Marlon, getting back to what I said earlier, and before your time on the council, when we did the Growing Healthier report and the whole issue of climate change, that, you know, there were the naysayers about climate change, and it's, yet this was, we had really important data about what was happening in Clark County, and so the reframe of that, we reframed it from just climate change to focusing back on that question that I raised, what's the impact on the health of people in Clark County? And so I think if we continually think about that, then it depoliticizes it. Mm-hmm. If we don't make it a political, you know, if we're sensitive to that.
I would add that the counselors now have a senior policy analyst to consult the resource. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, good point. Mm-hmm. She's really good. Her name is Lindsay Schaefer. And she's a policy analyst. That's a great point, Jeff. And we can actually have her, probably invite her to back at some point.
Yeah, and the idea would be to engage her too. As we start, you know, solidifying on some of the things that we might want to advocate for, that's when we'll bring her in and say, okay, what is your take? You know the council, you know where they're going, you know what their agendas are. Help us with, you know, this is what we want to advocate for, help us with that. And she's been super good so far about helping us with some of our messages.
Which makes me think, how does this align with our community health improvement plan? Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Where does this align with our, you know, getting back to the stakeholder group, you know, just the work that's going on here at public health with the community health improvement plan?
That's a really good point. We should have that available and take another look at that. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Has the Board of Health ever asked for any input? I mean, you talk to Board of Health a lot, but did they ever ask for help from our wonderful advisory council?
That's a good question.
I'm sure.
That's a fundamental one.
Well, I think the Growing Healthy report, when we first started doing it, I think that was something that they asked for. I think around the original mental health sales tax, they asked for an input on that. So the answer is yes.
But from what I understand, the Growing Healthy report became somewhat contentious.
Well, so there's the other thing about political feasibility.
Right,
there's elections.
Kind of like
political feasibility can change when there are elections or when charters are passed. So, but that makes it a little more interesting, isn't it? So, anyway, but yes.
And I would say on the flip side, too, where maybe the Board of Health doesn't regularly say, ask about facts, opinion on things, something, when we take a policy recommendation to the Board of Health, and we say FACT supports this, it gives it a lot of weight. They really...
I also can recall a couple times when we did not mention FACT support and they did ask.
That's right.
What's happening about this?
I think FACT helped with the vaping ordinance, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
There are a number of things that when we go to the board
NIP
with some...
The funding money for NIP?
Yeah.
Yeah. So when we do go to the Board of Health with something, being able to have VAC engaged really helps.
Well, and I think, you know, as many Board of Health meetings as I've been to, in the public health report, whether it's Alan or Roxanne, you know, if there's something that we've been involved with, it's mentioned that, you know, the FAP is working on this, or they're supportive of this, and so it's very much a part of public health's report about the kind of support they're getting from FAP.
So with the Growing Healthier report, was that the last major interaction that we had with the Board of Health? I mean, I know we have interactions, it sounds like quite a bit. Obviously, you have a lot of interactions, but
the most recent one was the baby.
And there wasn't any political drama with that. Negative on the advisory council, or negative just political?
It wasn't negative. But the community had very strong pros and cons coming before the council. So, you know, ultimately they are political, right? And so they were in a little bit of a difficult situation because they had strong groups advocating different ways.
Didn't we kind of agree with them, though, with letting them vape products on site so people could test their different oils?
In the vaping shops themselves.
Yeah, in the vaping. So we kind of met them halfway. Yeah. And so yes. I thought that was a good thing.
Their big issue was whether people could try out the different flavors and stuff.
Yeah.
And we said as long as they did it within the vaping shop, that was, and there was no HVAC connection with anybody else in the building. I remember it right.
Yeah.
By the way, your name came up today at the Board of Health when we, the County Council this morning when we talked about the, they approved a grant to do the mobile syringe exchange.
Oh, okay, good.
And we talked, we use your name as support for the mobile syringe exchange going to battle.
Gotta be careful with that every now, man. It's not gonna work.
They voted 5-0 to support it. And you know, the partnership with ShareHouse. But we talked about, you know, just invoking the name Chief Richardson goes a long way.
Yeah.
And anyway.
Thank you. Well, now I thought I could only make $5 on every syringe you guys get out.
So I think are there any questions on here that you guys are concerned about? Or are we out of the theater? Is there anything on here that you're thinking,
I like the one about the relationship to vulnerable populations. Mm-hmm. And it's just interesting. I just read today the ACEs Connection, a brand new report, follow-up report out on the ACEs study.
Yeah.
Looking at the vulnerable groups. Mm-hmm. It's pretty powerful study. 200,000 people. Follow-up of the original flooding and the study, you know, really targeting the groups that are most vulnerable.
Yeah, exactly.
When I was going through Vanover Labor Day, they had a big billboard on ACEs.
Yeah.
Something like, you know what your ACEs is.
Wow, really?
Right.
Well, that's wonderful.
And hopefully more providers, and I know more pediatricians are beginning to ask about ACE scores.
So I want to.
We're planning to train our primary care docs all in our ED docs.
That's great. So the other question we had really is how do we want to move through this process? So it sounds like we're all pretty good with the questions we've come up with regard to vetting. So the process, we could do a number of different things. We could pull together small groups or subsets of folks to work on this. We could ask if you wanted the executive staff or the executive team to work with public health staff and bring back recommendations, we could do that. So what do you all feel comfortable with regard to going through this vetting process? Because the next step is going to be we're going to look at our laundry list of items that we've come up with, understanding it's not necessarily an exhaustive list yet. Also look at the work that's already been done, being done by our public health staff members in those programs. Identify with this vetting process some things that maybe float to the top as potential opportunities to advocate for that we can come back and recommend to the group. But how would you like to handle that? Do you want to put together a subgroup set or a work group if people want to volunteer for that? Or would you prefer the staff would work with executive on that? Or are there other ideas? Those were just a couple ideas we came up with.
It feels to me like you kind of need to identify what data do we have available first and kind of look at the sources of that data, what's in there, because hopefully that will then help us identify really what's the scope of the problem or what is the measurable issue that we're trying to find.
Yeah.
And then from there, then we can start targeting some of these
absolutely
things.
So, and I think that will happen first, but as far as the process is concerned, I guess that's really more of a process question that I was asking about. So it's not, we're not going to get this group together right away until we have all these questions answered, because there's still a lot of stuff we have to do to really prepare this conversation. But process-wise, I mean, how would you like to move through that? I think the challenge is with the full group, it's very hard to vet, because I think we will end up, the end of next year, finally vetting what it is we want on our 2019 work plan, because there's a lot of conversation. So, you know, what makes sense to this group, and what would you feel comfortable with? And the idea would be that whatever we end up with, you know, after we have the data sources, because that's one of the things. If there's no data, then it might make it a fairly weak thing right to try to advocate for. Coming back and recommending to the group and sharing that sort of laundry list and where the using the criteria where these things, you know, fleshed or came to the wasn't fleshed out.
I wonder if it might make sense to have the executive committee talk about a process that we bring back to the larger group. What I'm sensing is maybe the data also might help us inform what the process will be.
Okay.
Well, I think then again, we're assigning the executives committee something that might, in terms of even these questions, is it feasible? And they might, I like that, Janice, that because then they might say, well, let's form a smaller work group, but let's have the executive committee work with the staff and come back with a recommendation.
Mm-hmm. For a process? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, so over and beyond the process that we're proposing here. So revisit this process and have the executive committee revisit the process again. It's on my notes, please.
That how we'll develop the work plan for 2019. I guess that's a process that you were talking about.
Okay, I'm so sorry.
Yeah. No, I'm sorry.
No. And I think that's part of what we're doing. The process that we've been going through that we've been talking about is really coming up with a laundry list of ideas and then figuring out how we're going to vet those, what makes sense, and then putting together the process for the work plan would be. Then, as we identify these topics, what is it that we're going to need in order to really fully, you know, advocate for whatever these topics end up being? And I think that's part of the full process with developing the work plan. Ideally, we'd like to end up with two or three items maybe that we would want to delve into for next year and really bring some opportunities to advocate around what would that look like. There may be a variety of different things that we do with those topics. So we can certainly go back and talk some more to the executive team about that process, and I'm fine with that.
Is there a way that we can ask the Board of Health? You know, they've got all different people that have different passions and things that they want to, you know, accomplish in their role. What they secret survey or something to say. What are the main? Not to get it too political, but what are the main things that you believe that public health should be focusing on for your, you know, your year?
Well, that's a great segue into what we're going to talk about in a few minutes.
But that might be something that can say, okay, well, these are the things that the counselors support so that we can find more information so that we can provide them with all the different, just the same thing that we're talking about with gun safety is that we hopefully can provide the, you know, commissioners with all the different avenues that our county does to promote gun safety, and are there gaps that we can help them that we see that the county isn't doing to decrease the amount of safety in our schools or in our retirees or however big those gaps are, but maybe they feel like, I don't know.
So what I think would be good is we'll take this back to the executive group and have some additional dialogue around where we think the process should go. Maybe there's some additional steps in here that we need to take. And then we can bring this back again and talk a little bit more about the vetting. Maybe in the interim, if there's any other criteria that you think that we should be considering for this process, I think that would be helpful too. I think we have a pretty good list, but there may be some things as you think about it some more, that there may be some other things that we can add or consider. And so what I'll do is I'll take this back then, and we'll have some further dialogue with Board of Health, and then we'll bring back at our next meeting, or the meeting after that, depending, on some additional recommendation. Is that kind of where everybody wants to go?
Is that clear enough to folks?
Okay, I can do that. So did you want to talk about next the...
Well, I mean, I think, so the next, the October, we're going to have our joint Board of Health and Advisory Council meeting and planning. And we need to kind of talk about how that meeting is going to go and how we envision it. And I guess one of my big questions to Roxanne and these guys is it our meeting or is it their meeting? So who does the presentation and do we listen or do we speak? And so a little bit of both, for sure.
I think it's a little bit of both. I know the prior year what we did is we gave the Board of Health an opportunity to talk about themselves and introduce themselves and talk about some of the things, and that might help also to inform our conversation around our work plan for 2019 too, but give them a chance to introduce themselves and their priorities. And then also we might want to consider thinking Councillor Bolt, he's not going to be continuing, I think pretty much we're all aware of that, but thanking him for his support in public health, because he's been a huge public health supporter. So we may have an opportunity to do that too, if you all would want to do something like that. So that was last year, we did the whole introduction and we kind of did, you know, what are the councilor's priorities. And then we introduced all the FAC members, so each FAC member got a chance to kind of, you know, not only introduce themselves and what they represent, but speak a little bit about, you know, go into a little bit more depth if you wanted to about what the sector that you represent or the organization. And then, you know, potentially what we did last year is sort of just gave them an update on what we were working on. And so we could do the same format this year. We could talk about ACEs, we could talk about working on schools, you know, getting data on school suicides and other things. But really we wanted to get your ideas about what you would like for this meeting. A lot of it is meeting and greeting and getting an understanding of kind of where they're going. But they also want to know what we're interested in and where we're going as well. So it's an opportunity for us.
I don't know how many of them are going to show up because we don't have it on the calendar yet.
Oh, it was on the calendar.
Is it on the calendar?
Yeah, we've been talking to them about it for a while. So
I haven't looked at their calendar, so okay.
Unless something's changed.
All right, as long as you're sure about
that. It's supposed to be the October meeting.
Okay.
Right?
So the October 16th meeting.
It's our regular FAC meeting in October.
Oh, so
we'll just invite them to join us here.
We'll talk.
Yeah.
We'll make sure.
So, you know, again, opening it up for a dialogue, what are your thoughts? Do you want to kind of go with what we went with last year as far as the agenda, or are there specific...
Well, I think it would be important for us to say that one of the things that we're working on right now is we are getting some data and background information to look at the issue of what we can do to, prevent violence and promote gun safety in the community, but that we're doing our due diligence, getting the data, I think is important, and then we also get a sense from them about what they would like us to, maybe they'll have a question that they would like us to look at, so, but to present, to do that is we're doing some background work.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that's important. And then the other thing that I brought up last time is, like, I think I would, we did so much work on the Growing Healthier report to just ask, you know, is there any more follow-up that they would like us to do on that Growing Healthier report? You know, do they want an update or it's really important. And it's like I think about that. I was at the Commission on Aging meeting right before this, and it's like it's part of it's the Growing Healthier report all over again, because you're looking at transportation, and the COA's meeting tonight was on walkable communities, and they had a guest speaker from the city of Tigard talking about how Tigard wants to become the most walkable city in the Pacific Northwest. And they had somebody from the city talking about this. And they're talking about the Golden Center, and it's like, we did a lot of that work in the Growing Healthier report. And it's like it's now been put on the shelf, and I would like us to pull it off the shelf again. There's a lot of good stuff in there related to housing, to green spaces that could be very useful.
Well, you might also remember that we once had a position that one of our, Brendan Haggerty, who is an urban planner, was part of our department, and we lost that position a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Something we may want to look at down the road.
I don't think we'd want to bring it up, though.
No.
Not
that
position right now, yeah, exactly.
Not right before bed.
Thank you, Janice.
Yes.
I want to make sure I have a job, yes.
The other way we could possibly pose that question to them is, you know, what are their priorities around healthy community or transportation?
That's a great one.
I think we should ask them.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that would be helpful.
Housing. Transportation.
I'm kind of curious on budget, you know, they're kind of trying to figure that out and where there's been that different departments go talk to them and stuff. I don't know if we can do any politicking or what the deal, or is it subject we should go on?
I think one place where you guys will be really helpful is, it's not just with our council, because they're supportive of the Board of Health. It's the ask we're going to make to the state about foundational public health services one day. So that's going to be in the next session. And
I would like to, yeah, I'd talk to them about that again and bring out this.
We might want to talk to them about that.
Yeah.
Well, I can remember Mark Bolt saying, you know, he said, don't worry about making us feel comfortable. When you guys take a position, that really helps us to make a decision sometimes. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, terms of budget, if that makes much difference at this point.
I think that's what Mark is asking, is not about way in the future, specifically for next month's joint Board of Health FAC meeting, advocating about budget is the timing, right? I think, is that?
Yeah, or, you know, are we, what cuts are we looking at, or what cuts do we prefer over others?
Jeff, correct me if I'm wrong, but we really have not been told what's going to happen with the budget at this point. We haven't really gotten much information, so I don't know, like, if.
That's a good timing.
Well, I think the question is that we say, you know, it's just what Mark is saying is what are their budget priorities, you know, where does public health and some of the issues about the health of the community fit in there, you know, and under that then falls transportation, housing,
well,
but to just sort of say, get a sense of the priorities.
Here's one thing where you might be really helpful on that is one of the budget priorities coming up is going to be around the jail. And one of the opportunities for FAC is to talk about, yeah, there's going to be a big push for a new jail, but there's also other ways to reduce the demand for jail beds, and you know that's where the prevention piece comes in. Just something to think about.
If I could tag on to that, you know, and this is an issue that it has the potential to blot out the sun, and it's homelessness, and it's. You know, our office is at 811 Main, and I frequently have guests who ramble about the CIA following them, and they are unhealthy, and they are allowed to roam the streets. And I mean, it's a serious problem. And in the dialogue that I've had with people at sort of senior staff level in the county outside of public health, we're spending a lot of money on homeless. We spend all kinds of money on it, and there are systems, and there. People talk to me about the mental health sales tax, and but I'm wondering about street level services for people who really need help. And that seems to me that's a really, really tough one to crack. And if you talk to law enforcement, especially downtown, arresting them is not an answer. And telling them to move on is not an answer. And I know this is, again, people's eyes glaze over when we get to the subject of homelessness, but it is really, especially with the mental health component. And Alan, how many weeks ago was it that there was Hep C or something in California in the homeless population, and it was
Hepatitis A. We're still concerned. Yes.
I mean that's another one. And yeah. I think back to the investigation you were doing at Skyview High School a couple of weeks ago on TB, and it goes back to funding. So it just seems like there's so many tentacles to this issue.
And that's why we have that partnership with ShareHouse. Syringe exchange.
Yeah.
But you know, being homeless is a risk factor for being in jail, so you're much more likely to end up in jail if you're homeless. So.
And I don't know how
jail
to
is an expensive place.
For this, I don't know how to package it.
Yeah.
It's what's on my mind.
Yeah.
Well, I definitely think it's a great idea that Adrian came up with about asking them questions, you know, and giving them an opportunity to tell us what, you know, what their priorities are and, you know, what about the situation? What are your thoughts on that? And have them give us some feedback, because that will allow us to understand kind of where their heads are, but also understand there may be some opportunities for education for the Board of Health or advocacy, other types of advocacy work that we could do with them, depending on what their, you know, what their comments are back to us from those questions.
And that's exactly how we were charged initially with doing the Growing Healthier report. It was, we were educating them on the is inequality making us sick, and we showed some of those segments and we talked about that, and it was based on the discussion and the questions following those is inequality making us sick segments that they said, well, what are we doing? Let's, you know, we have this opportunity with the growth plan coming up to make some work to provide us with some guidance about how we can grow healthier. So it was based on a very similar type of meeting that we took on, educating them on some of what was going on in that documentary series, Is Inequality Making Us Sick?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I think Adrian's right, though. We particularly right now, we need to understand what their 200 or 300 pound gorillas are that they're trying to deal with. I know that they probably have more than that. And maybe if we can even just ask them ahead of time, you know, have them mm-hmm. think about, here's the issues that they're trying to deal with. I agree, mental health and homelessness is just a huge issue that we're having to deal with in the community, and we've not been able to come to grips with it at all.
Even gun safety, I think, could be just the gun safety might just be too much nitty gritty.
It may not be timely, is right? For them when they're trying to deal with. Because the jail wraps up all the homelessness and the mental health and all the other, I mean, part of the problem with
that. Right now they have a commission that's looking at the jail, just, I happen to be.
But I think foundational public health services is something that is like the, mm-hmm. the God above that covers everything. And so it's kind of like, it encompasses most of our mission of just trying to support financially and also all the different aspects of public health that we deal with, mental health, you know, and then all the other.
But I think on an individual level, they each have some things they're pretty passionate about.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
You know, they've also been very interested in the work that we've done on the ACEs, you know, when Cindy's been here talking about that. And so they could ask about, you know, really we've moved beyond just what ACEs is doing, but into trauma-informed, and, you know, really that could be something that...
Well, I think a lot of the information that we got from Bob tonight would be really, you know, I think we should talk about some of the things that we've been doing, but maybe not get into the weeds.
They're also really, around ACEs, they're really supportive of the nurse-family partnership. And they understand the connection between the NFP and ACEs mitigation.
But, you know, I'm not sure they're aware of all the incredible work that's going on in our schools right now on trauma-informed schools group, and all the work that's going on about, you know, in our schools. They may not be aware of that, and that's countywide what's going on there. So
we are going to have the Prevent Coalition, they're not Prevent Coalition anymore, they're just Prevent. They're going to be presenting at the Board of Health meeting next week and talking about sort of their annual review of what they've done, so they'll be able to get a little bit of that, so that could be something that they might have in mind too. So what we'll do is we'll take this back to the executive committee, if you guys are okay with that, and we'll put the agenda together and we'll confirm. The meeting will be here. We'll have an agenda set and ready to go. We won't be talking about any of our normal, you know, we won't be talking about this process probably of the next, the process we talked about earlier at our next meeting.
I think it's good if we talk to them about this list that we've come up with about issues. I think
sure.
That would be a
very
important
point. I mean, I think these are the criteria for our advocacy, because that's a big part of our mission, is that these are what we're working on, is just to get a little bit more streamlined and have some more criteria so that we don't just keep babbling about nothing and not do anything. There's reasons why we want to talk about something. So I think that might be.
Sure.
good that we're developing a criteria.
And then do you want to, are you going to assign people to sort of take the, you know, like a, there, like, there would be 6 points that we're going to talk about. Are you going to assign people to sort of take the lead and be prepared to do that?
That's probably going to be the best thing so that we, it's not just sort of a free for all discussion.
Because somebody might, nobody would say anything.
Sometimes that happens just for their clients.
So going to be, so before we were, I think that what we said was we were going to be a small group together to plan kind of how it was going to be so that we have some strategy around health to best utilize that time, that's precious time with the Board of Health. And so that's what we're talking about right now, but
we can get,
there's just not a lot of time between now and that meeting, so I just wondered. And how do we just, we want to have a good impact so that they look forward to the next time when we get together. And I just think it's a golden opportunity not to to miss. I very personally, I think that foundational public health is so important that I would really love it if we have some conversation about that. It is sort of the umbrella under which everything else hangs, but I think, so maybe we prioritize or do some kind of a prioritization matrix, you know, easy to do it, versus hard and high impact versus no, and see where some of these things fall before we meet with them. I mean, I'm just trying to think of how to organize the potential opportunities in to pick things that they will be very interested in. And I really also like the idea of hearing from them. Most of all, that's the most important thing of all. So those are just kind of my two cents.
Would there be some people that would like to volunteer to help us with planning the agenda?
Yay!
Okay. Ron, anybody else have time between now and...
We'll do whatever you tell me to do.
Awesome.
My name, okay, great. And if it works out, I could come, but okay. I'm so busy right now, I don't know if I could. I wouldn't want to have to work around my schedule.
Yeah, I'll be on the phone for a week, but I can maybe
do a phone. Yeah, we can do it by phone, too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I could do that.
Okay, so, anybody else?
If you can do it by phone, I can.
Yeah, I'll see
you. Or we'll make up a webcast or whatever, so
we'll make it easy for you.
Well, we can do it during our...
executive.
Yeah.
We have Paul an option.
Yeah.
And we can ask the, we'll certainly ask the Board of Health members for their, what their interests are.
So just to clarify, are we saying that we're going to talk to the Board of Health about kind of their priorities, so the gun safety may not necessarily be something that we will be working on for 2019? Is that accurate?
Well, I think you can ask them about their priorities, but I think they may have some questions for you about your priorities as well. I'm hoping it'll be more of a dialogue as well.
So I think we definitely, the outreach to Board of Health would be, you know, what are your top two or three big issues? And then what else would you, you know, what other questions might you have? And so that can help inform the conversation as well. So we'll do that.
Might be nice to have before the planning.
Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, we're meeting with them next week. Is it next week? Yeah.
When was the last meeting that we had in 2 years?
I think it's been, I think it was last year, wasn't it? Was it last year?
I feel like we've only had one meeting since I've been
on the... I don't know about last year.
I think it was 2 years ago.
The other thing is, there's going to be at least one new, counselor, a new Board of Health member.
But not next month, right?
No, January, yeah.
I don't know if you want to do just a simple flow chart of exactly what we do.
Well, like the flow chart that you gave us, I thought it was really helpful on just like when you're doing...
Oh, the calendar?
I don't think this was it.
The org chart?
I don't know if this was the org chart. You just did one on just the last meeting. I was kind of trying to find
the one that listed what programs...
It was really on the gun safety, but I feel like that was really helpful for me to see like all the programs.
Yeah.
Good thing. So it helped me. I didn't think
they out
like that. Yeah.
Oh, the crosswalk.
Yeah. The crosswalk. Yeah. I don't know if you can, we can make it without having to reinvent the wheel about just the gun safety aspect.
I would just want to be careful
right.
with that because
I wouldn't have guns. It would just be this and then the project leads and then just this and then the projects.
Although some of those projects aren't totally fleshed out yet, so that would be
more
interesting. The Board of Health can get very much into operations, so we want to be careful.
Well, I don't know if we have to think that is more technical.
Their role is policy level role.
Just updating our logic.
We have it on the cardboard.
We'll
bring that and post it up.
Oh, the socio-ecological?
No,
Now my son stuck one.
There's a whole nice later cable too.
A couple opportunities, but both of them are missing.
Okay, so what we'll do then is we'll go back and we'll poll the Board of Health. We'll set up the meeting with our volunteers, and if anybody so chooses to volunteer or wants to be part of the call-in, just let me know. We'll set up a call-in, and we'll also have an in-person meeting to plan the final agenda. And the meeting will be here. The setup's always kind of awkward, but last time that we met, we had them over there. I think we had some challenges with some of the just the acoustics. So we'll see if we can.
Well, we have the microphones.
We have the microphones now, great. So we can probably use the microphones now.
If there's three or more of them, it will be a public
meeting.
Be announced a week ahead of time.
Okay. Might be some public. Okay.
Great. By the way, I heard correctly that they ran out of money this year for City of Vancouver TV to televise the Board of Health meetings, but I think next year they will be televised. So
we found some money.
It sounds like we need volunteers for the nominating committee. you can speak.
Sure. Okay, so prior to the, you guys are so sleepy, I'm sorry. You go home and like have this voice in your head.
Can't get enough of it,
So the nomination committee needs to be scheduled before our November meeting and recommend the slate of council members to serve as the executive committee. And then after that, the committee will be selected by a vote of the council at the first regular meeting in 2019. So basically, the nominating committee gets together, does the nominations, and then the voting will happen at our first meeting in January. So who, is there anybody that would be willing to take a look at our nominees? It's probably a very quick meeting. We could do it by phone too, we could do it in person. Anybody would like to have three members if possible?
I can do it again.
Okay, great.
Just because you're on the nominating committee doesn't mean that you avoid being nominated.
Remy knows all the other things, that's really good.
Yeah, that happened to Remy last time. Doesn't work.
Anybody else willing to?
I'll do it if you don't have anybody else. Now, my goodness.
Bob and Joan?
Yeah, I've done it all the many years. So.
Can we have someone else on executive be already on executive to do the? I guess we could.
It doesn't matter because I already know who I'm going to squeeze into some votes.
Okay. All right, so Steve, Joan, and Bob, so we'll set that meeting up too. Thank you, guys.
All right. Nice job, Roxanne.
Thank you.
On to announcements. It looks like you've got announcements. You may not be done. The Firearm Tragedy Extension Network.
Yeah. So we definitely want to make sure that you all are aware of some of the upcoming things, especially on our specific topic, but we'll be announcing other things as well. There's a Washington State Firearm Tragedy Prevention Network meeting November 13th, and we'll include the link in the notes, but if anybody from your agencies is interested in learning more about this, Bob, do you know something specific about this or not?
No, I don't.
No, you don't. You know Project Child Safe.
Yes, ma'am.
So we'll include these on the notes if anybody is interested. And we can hopefully get some information back from this too. Even if we don't attend, the idea is to get some information back from this and see how it goes. The second thing is the Project Child Safe. We'll be including this in a link as well. There's a lot of information online about this, but there's sort of at a glance on the back of the page that gives you an idea of what they're going to be focusing on. This is their annual review, or what they focused on. So this is basically their look back at Project Child Safe and what they're in. You know, what the program was before and the results from this program. So this is in a nutshell what this is. And Lydia, I think we're going to be including the full. Do you have any other discussion about this, Bob?
No, it's just something I found. I'm actually going to copy. We're going to change our, you know, we give out about 200 concealed weapons permits a year, just our agency does. So instead of giving a paper one, I'm going to make a nice plastic ID card with certain information on it. And then I'm going to put it in a little card holder that you open up. It's going to have references to gun safety resources and things like that. So to just send it to them, we'll have something nicely open up. It'll have references to gun safety and those kinds of things. Like, that's what I'm going to do. That's what I got that idea, I think, off that website.
They have some, if you guys have a chance to go to this website, they have some tremendous information on their website. And they've done a lot of stuff that we've been talking about and things that are happening in our community as well. But distributing locks, you know, the Lock It Up, their public service announcements, we had talked about that a little bit earlier, but safety is a habit. Those sorts of things where there's some evidence around us now where we can actually pull some additional data in terms of these sorts of evidence. So we'll include this on the notes too and when they come out too, so you guys can take a look at this.
Good. Are there any council member updates?
Well, I already mentioned about the ACES study, and I'm going to send that. I'll send that link to
you. Please.
But what I wanted to share is I've been on DCYF advisory group. I think I mentioned this before on trauma-informed care group for child care in the state, and it's meant I've had four meetings in Seattle for the last 4 weeks, up and back and up and back, but making recommendations to the legislature about what we can do to reduce expulsions from child care. And it's an alarming problem that we, it's just alarming when you hear the data that kids in child care. And only about 30% of our kids in the state of Washington are in, early ECAP programs, Head Start programs, early Head Start programs. So we're talking about those 30% of kids that are in organized child care. The expulsion rate of kids from organized child care is 13 times the rate of expulsions from kids in K-12. And it's alarming because you take let's take an example. We've had a lot of stories about this. You take a child who's chronologically 4 years old but developmentally is only about 2 years old because they're living in a bunch of toxic stress in their family, and so they're in child care and so they're living in a very toxic environment, but when they go to the one place that can provide stability to a child is the ECAP program or the Head Start program, but they're in that program and because they're traumatized or developmentally delayed, they bite somebody. Which, for a two-year-old, you teach him not to bite, but this guy is 4 years old. And so the norm has been to expel them from child care, which re-traumatizes that child. And so the legislature wants to eliminate expulsions as a possibility. And so that means you have to train the workers, you have to have programs that maybe deal with kids who we know are highly stressed. It's a very complex process, so we will be making recommendations by the end of this month to go back to the legislature about what it would take to implement that. And one of the things that's come out of that as well is when you're dealing with trauma-informed, you're not only dealing with the people that are affected, you're dealing with the people who provide the services. And child care workers are some of the poorest paid people in the state. And so there's got to be some, over the course of time, and in fact, the governor is putting forth a proposal. he's asked the Department of Children, Youth, and Families to come up with a proposal to deal with early childhood that might help us deal with some of the issues that we have in this state that go along with this expulsion rate. So,
just out of curiosity, what do you do with that? You know, you're running a business.
It's a business, yeah.
Yeah, and you've got this child that's out of control inviting kids, so the other parents are telling you, hey, you need to take care of this problem. You've got your risk management, your insurance carrier issues. So I was just curious how you solve
it. Well, a lot of it you deal with training. A lot of it is just what you've done with your officers, trauma informed. And it's, but you know, there's not enough money to give time off for childcare workers to get the training. There's environmental pieces. It's very complex. And you know, there's some kids that and so you talk about maybe there's specialized childcare for kids who are really developmentally behind and are very traumatized. Working on this, getting all this data, and we've lived in a world of data on trauma informed. It's just alarming, just alarming. And then you think about, this is only about 30% of the kids that are served in the state of Washington. There's 70% of the kids who aren't even in organized childcare. And of those kids, there are some kids that receive what we himself call football care. Today, Stephanie takes care. Next day, it's the neighbor. Next day, so that child has no stability. And so they're just racking up those aces just right after another. So it's a... So the governor in the this is his last term, and Frank Ordway was there, who's our point person from the new Department of Children, Youth, and Families. They proposed an incredible model to the governor, which may be in the governor's budget, really looking at how can we provide child care to all children in the state, you know, make sure that we're having better outcomes for our kids. And it gets back to the WAP Kids data, kids readiness for kindergarten. You know, only 46% of our kids in the state are ready for kindergarten, especially in that whole area of social emotional and being able to regulate the behavior. And let me tell you, one of the most strong proponents on the task force has been Dr. Judy McBitty, who's been here in Clark County doing trainings for us in terms of, you know, it's about teaching that those social emotional skills and self-regulation, and where we learn self-regulation from our parents. And if you don't have parents that are going to teach you that, then the next place is the people in the community, whether it's childcare or the neighbor, how can we really increase that? So it's been a lot of work, but most of all, it's been extremely informative. I'm overwhelmed with information on trauma informed care. And I think we need to create a trauma informed world is the solution. it's not just about kids. It's about everybody. It's like, how can we become a trauma-informed world, or country at least? So, yeah, that's all I have.
Any other updates, comments, questions?
Oh, one really quick is, last night I gave out our first naloxone save on an officer that got a call of a patient down, they needed an AED, he got there, 26-year-old patient's on the ground, is blue. And his brother's giving him chest compressions, and the officer gets an naloxone nasal spray out, and gives him his dose, and within 5 minutes he's up talking and he's alive again. You just go, wow!
Isn't that great? Yeah. It's like magic.
So I took the little nasal spray and I gave it to the council and let him pass it. I go, this is probably $130, but save a human being's life. So that's pretty cool.
The officer must have felt pretty good.
Yeah.
Do you have to redose that after?
I'm sorry?
How long does that last? Yeah. It depends on the driver.
It depends on what they have on board.
Yeah.
So generally you do need to watch it. I mean, they may refuse, but they should go to the ED and be observed.
We just got there before the paramedics. We still have the paramedics follow up behind us.
And, you know, if they've overdosed on something long-acting like methadone, it can take, it depends on the drug. And something really potent like fentanyl, yeah, you might have to do repeated. So you should take them to the
ED. It's a great
drug, animals. Well, it depends on the opioids. Some of them are long, like methadone is very long.
But naloxone.
Yes, that's correct. Short act. Yeah. Yes. Yes. That's great.
That's what it's for.
Saving lives.
Yeah.
It's a lot better than using that taser.
And what I tell them, when I tell the fire department, because we have AEDs and naloxone now, that we save more lives than they do now.
But you guys come across the likelihood of saving somebody with naloxone versus an AED.
Oh, it's a lot higher.
I'm going for naloxone, given how many people die of opioid overdose versus cardiac arrest.
Anybody can get trained. Just go to the harm reduction center, and you'll get the training. And I drive, I have it in my car, and drive in my speed car, and meet the clients and get more.
And what's really cool is now that we're going to hopefully have the mobile syringe exchange, they'll be distributing naloxone to folks who are IV drug use, you know, opioid users and their families in the battleground areas, among other places.
One of our folks, Carrie Hacker, who is the program manager for our STD and HIV prevention team, is took the lead on writing the grant for ShareHouse for the services. And so we'll be supplying some, subject matter expertise, but they're going to run with it. But they needed some help with actually writing the grant, so she's done a fantastic job in that. And it's...
The other thing that's going to benefit is that there's going to be working with ShareHouse, the folks, and I think they're going to be doing with Shugel and Camas areas as well, is providing access to opioid users. So if they come to the syringe exchange and they're interested, they'll be getting them access to medication-assisted treatment.
Good.
So getting folks on start on treatment. The other thing you guys might want to know is that the Palm River Mental Health and the jail and the sheriff's office just got a grant from SAMHSA. I think it's a $1.5 million grant over 3 years to actually initiate medication-assisted treatment in the jail. Right now, they're continuing people on it when they come in, but they're going to be able to start people on it who are interested in the jail. So that should help reduce some of the overdoses in the community as well.
You know, one of the things, when I was at the Harm Reduction Center, and I, was getting my training, for my naloxone, one of the things that we're missing in this community is making sure that anybody who's on an opioid pain management program is getting the awareness of naloxone. It's a missing piece.
Yeah.
So if somebody's on a pain management program, they should have naloxone in their home. The family member should have that, should there be in. Whether there's an accidental overdose by the person who's on opioids or from a kid who gets into mom or dad's opioids. And that's a missing piece that when I was talking with Sandy and Brandy about it, that there's not an organized way to, if you're on an opioid pain management program, part of that education of being on that pain management program should be making sure you have Narcan available and you understand it's how to use it. So, and it's, and that gets back to our primary care providers that are putting people on opioid pain management plan.
Yeah.
Okay. If not, it would be a motion to adjourn. If everybody's finished, then I'm not saying we are adjourned.
All right.